Every time I start recording, I always burp. Every time.
That's weird. Hey, that's kind of weird.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. And today's episode, oh my God, you guys. So today's episode for our guest, we have Trish Franks, who is one of my oldest, dearest, bestest friends. We went to 6th through 12th grade together. Sometimes I will just find myself being like, you know what? The world is so lucky that they have Trish in it. Like, genuinely, like, what the heck? Just like sometimes I was just like, thank gosh, you know, thank goodness to gosh. So let me read your bio. emailed me. Trish is a teacher and education advocate originally from Rockville, Maryland. You cannot hurt her feelings because she has taught sixth grade history for 4 years in Boston. She believes education is the most powerful tool for transforming lives, offering people opportunities and choices. She is now preparing to start a legislative fellowship with the Utah State Board of Education to monitor and shape education policy. When she is not learning new words like skibbity and sigma with the kiddos, she enjoys crafting, playing pickleball, making new friends, dominating board games, and reading along with Required Reading, the only podcast she listens to regularly. Say more about that, about reading along with a podcast. Oh my
I would
gosh.
love to. I'm not paid to do this, but Erin, I had a gap in my book club career. I've had a book club for a while, and then I had a gap, and I was like, I miss talking to somebody about books. And I was like, wait, I could do this with Erin. So I have been reading books I haven't read. I hate spoilers, so only the ones I haven't read. I read them, and then my treat is to listen to your podcast. And it has taken me on some hilarious journeys, including The Little House in the Big Woods, which I'd never heard of before, and had such a blast. Like, I was like, I have no one to talk to about this. Thank goodness I've already pre-planned a book club with Erin, and listening to that was such a pleasure.
Oh my gosh.
So
Oh
fun.
my gosh.
Highly recommend to anyone. Ideal.
Oh. We went to 6th through 12th grade together. We did not really, I don't think we knew each other in 6th grade at all, is
We
my,
were close. Yeah, I know they were close.
no. I think my memory is like I met two of our mutual friends in 7th grade French class. And then I think 8th grade, we had math class together. And that's when we started to rock the world.
That is such a better memory than I could possibly have about our middle school experience. Already, you remember so much more. I remember that you liked Merlin, and I started watching Merlin because of that. And that's, I think, my first time remembering Erin Bowles was like lunchroom. You had a scrapbook of Merlin, the TV show, for those of you who don't know. And I saw it, and I was like, what could this possibly be? And then me and my mom watched the whole series together.
That's crazy because I had forgotten about that scrapbook until a couple months ago. I went to my parents' house, and I found it. Like, this was a birthday gift from a friend, and it was a scrapbook about like every single episode for like 3 seasons of this
Oh my
British
gosh.
show, biographies of different characters. But speaking of birthday gifts, you gave me, I think, the best gift I've ever received in my life, which was 11th grade. You got this like little photo album and went around and got people in our class to write like little notes about like I admire you and I like this about you and you said this smart thing from all the kids in the class. And it was like 11th grade was really rough and it rocked my world. And what a sweetie. Oh my gosh.
I don't even remember that. I mean, I love you and I remember that love, but oh my gosh, that's so clear. I got a gift from you that changed my world, and it was you reading me a book. You remember doing this? You
Yes,
read
I
out
forgot about
loud
that.
a book to me, my first audiobook, really. And I was like, wow, the time, the effort. We really, I mean, we had no, what else did we have to do in high school, right?
This is probably wrong, but I might have recorded that on a Barbie boom box.
I hope that's true. Even if it's not, that should be true.
Your birthday party right after we finished high school, like 2 weeks after we finished high school, I see as the beginning of my acting career. I won an award that night.
And you deserved it. It was a 20th birthday party. And I picked out characters for everybody. It was a murder mystery. And Erin was the report. No, wait, what? Where you were waitress.
Bartender.
Okay, wait, bartender. I was like, you were collecting drinks though. Hold on a second.
I
Anyway,
was.
Not actual drinks, everybody. It was so cute. You were the cutest, most adorable, just really involved. That's so fun. I hope that was the start because I love Welcome to Flatch. And I had no idea you had that in you. But also,
Me either.
it made a lot of sense when I saw it, you know?
I remember for that, I was like, I have a little bow tie that I clipped into my shirt, and I just got a towel, and I was just pretending to towel down any
Oh my
surface.
gosh, that's so, that was so funny. It was such a good choice. Great choices all through. Oh, so
Incredible
funny.
casting director. Yeah.
Wow, thank you. Your first casting director.
I know.
That's a list I want to be on. I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, I guess it's time. Our book today. It's you picked such a good one. Just in general, like I think, so it's The Giver from 1993 by Lois Lowry. Winner of the 94 Newbery Medal. Lois Lowry is one of only six people to have won the Newbery twice. And this book, I feel like, is a staple just of like children's literature. We read it in sixth grade. I remember we had a project about it, about naming, that introduced me to one of my favorite websites, behindthename.com. I use it to
No
this
way.
day.
No way. Okay.
Yeah. Let's how do we how would we describe this book? This is how I got introduced to both utopias and dystopias. Let me read the back of the book.
Yeah,
Jonas's
please.
world is perfect. Everything is under control. There is no war or fear or pain. There are no choices. Every person is assigned a role in the community. When Jonas turns 12, he is singled out to receive special training from the Giver. The Giver alone holds the memories of the true pain and pleasure of life. Now it's time for Jonas to receive the truth. There is no turning back.
I mean, yeah, I mean, absolutely. It is as epic as it sounds.
Yeah. Let me paint the scene a tiny bit. It's 1993. Clinton is inaugurated for the first time. We get the first female Attorney General of the US, Janet Reno. And then I wanted to keep it fun, so I found three things that I thought would make you giggle. Number one, the Backstreet Boys are formed. Number two, the first Power Rangers series premieres.
Wow, okay.
And number three, I don't know if this was in your childhood. It was in mine. VeggieTales starts.
You ended on the highest note. Yes, absolutely. 100%. 100%. Also, Jonah? Jonas? Interesting. Interesting. Delicious. Yes. I will say, as a fan of this podcast, I was like, should I make my own list of things that happened in 1993? I was just trying to like listen to the beginnings of how you introduce people. And I saw there was another book in 1993. I was like, oh, maybe she'll just do the same. No, you didn't. You chose different things. And thank you for that.
What was the other 93 book?
I can't remember.
But Lois Lowry, I did a little digging on her. One of my favorite things about it is that her father was an army dentist, so she moved around a lot growing up. She became a journalist with sort of some of her first writing projects. And so we were talking about this before we started recording. The cover that I have is the one that we had in sixth grade, and it has this old man on the front, which I think is like the definitive cover. And so it was bothering me so much because I was like, I know this man's face beyond just knowing this book. Like, I know this man's face. I didn't. I was wrong. But like an hour ago, I was Googling it. This man is a painter named Carl Nelson that Lois Lowry, like decades before she wrote this, interviewed and photographed while she was a journalist. And then after he died, she used his photo to be the Giver, who is this old receiver of memories.
Interesting. I think often like the illustrations for books are so disconnected from authors, especially covers of YA books. I sometimes wonder, I'm like, does this author have any choice in this? That's amazing. Oh my gosh, what a fun fact. That's
Thank you. I
wild.
found that out an hour ago.
I'm so glad.
My copy, I found it in a little free library. It has a literal library card in it. It has four names on it, and the last person who checked it out was Trevor Kelly, who checked it out in September 10th, 2007. And I think we would have read this in September of 08.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Oh my gosh, it makes sense. That's so cute. I had such a little blast grabbing mine from the library and ended up grabbing the whole quartet, which I'm sure we will
Yes.
discuss. But I'm just so excited. I'm like in the middle, no, towards the end of gathering blue right now. I'm loving it. Yeah.
So let me ask you the question. What's your story with this book? Because we didn't really know each other in sixth grade. How do you remember it?
Okay, so I have always been like, I love The Giver. Lois Lowry is my author. Now, did I remember anything that happened in this book? No. I knew it
Oh.
was a dystopia, and I couldn't remember anything else to the point where I was shocked chapter one rereading. I didn't even remember that The Giver was about memories. I had nothing.
Nope.
Well, it's just interesting because I always thought this book was amazing, important. I loved it with no actual substantial memory of what had happened. But I think what makes this book kind of special to me is not only my love for it, but also the fact that I feel like it connected me to all the other middle schoolers in the United States, and still connects me to all of these people. Because me and Aaron, we didn't go to we went to a public middle school, obviously, but we were in a different program, kind of like a gifted and talented program. And it meant that our curriculum was a little bit different. And I don't feel like we got all of those same milestones as maybe the average American teenager. I never read The Outsiders, another classic middle school book, things like that. But
That's why I started this podcast. Yeah, because
okay,
there were so
yeah.
many things that we just didn't like. We never read Dickens. We just, there's all these things that like everyone else read that I had never read. Oh.
Yeah, so I love the fact that this is such a universally important book. And then now as a middle school teacher, I was like, what a pleasure it would be to I mean, I taught sixth grade, and this is one of those classic books, and I just read The Outsiders for the first time this year with my students. And I was like, I think it would just be so fun to reread this, and wow, what a powerful choice it was. Yeah. I'm
Yeah.
so glad.
I think it was maybe the first book we read in sixth grade. I know we also read Anthem by Ayn Rand.
I
Why I
was like a
remember
really intense journal keeper at the time, and my journals are full of drama and crushes. And I'm like, why didn't I write a single thing? I tried to find when we would have read it. I'm just pure drama in there. But it's interesting because books impress us and influence us, even if we're not I don't know, I'm not cognizant. And it was the first of many dystopias I ended up reading, right? And YA novels of this kind. So it's impossible to pretend like it didn't impact my appreciation of the next books in my life, right?
I think we read this book probably the year that Hunger Games came out for the first time, was published. It was so like aughts was so dystopia focused. And I think I loved this, something I loved about this book that I didn't, because I also, no memory. I vaguely remembered the naming project that we had to like observe another student and then name them something. And I remember I got, we'll bleep out his name. I was like, I don't care about this person at all. What a boring person. So I named him Asher, and then reading this, I was like, you picked a name that is in the
That's so funny. Of all the names. And I'm sure you wrote something amazing about it and got a good grade, like you would. That's so annoying.
I remember that was the class where I learned what double spaced means, and I didn't ask my mom at first, so I was putting two spaces between every word. So it took me like an hour, and I was crying because I was like, it's taking so long. And I remember I like hated our English teacher. I thought none of his assignments made sense. He made them all up on his bicycle on the way to work, and he just wanted to be our friend and make us laugh, and he didn't care about education. And then the next year he became a math teacher, and I was like, see, he doesn't even care about English.
You know what's so interesting about the naming thing is that he is one of the only teachers. So obviously, my name is Patricia. I now go by Trish in middle school, and I tried to change it in high school, but my friends refused to let me change it to Trish. I went by
Sorry.
Trishy, right, the rest of my life before then. And he laughed at my name the day one. And I don't know why. It just got to me a little bit. I was like, oh my gosh, is this
Oh.
embarrassing? Is this a little embarrassing to have this name? It's funny because it's part like the naming ceremony, or like his naming was a part of your memory of The Giver. I mean, my other big memory of him was that he had the sign language letters up on his board, on his wall. And I learned the whole alphabet the sign language alphabet. And I've always thought about that, even as a teacher now, I think you always spend so much time trying to daydream at school. You should put up something on your wall because kids will look. Kids are always staring at the walls. You might as well put something up that's important and helpful. And I did learn my whole freaking sign language alphabet from him.
That's so crazy because I remember a piece of artwork from his classroom and it was World Peas. That's the one I remember.
We both learned important things staring at the wall. Wow.
That's so funny. I also remember we had to, as part of that name project, we had to define our own names. My middle name is Robertson, which is my mom's last name. So I was like, I looked it up and it was like, I looked at the name Robert and I was like, and it means brave and this and that. And I remember finishing and our teacher being like, yeah, it probably means son of Robert. I think that was like, you're dead to me now.
And we're done. Because you made
Well,
me look this up, and now you're making fun of me for him.
and you're singing a little song on your guitar, and I don't think it's cool. I want you to know that I continued to be like that in college. I continued to be like, I'm here to learn, and we don't have time to mess around. I'm here to learn.
You feel that that was going to be maybe a conflict in your artistic school that you went to? I could feel that maybe the design school that you went to was gonna have issues with what did you earn, like award for being the most perfect little student of our humanities award. I mean, you could feel there was gonna be a conflict. You could see that coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't shock me. Yeah.
The award was called Leader of the Liberal Arts. I do
That's
remember,
great.
of course.
That's crazy.
I remember how much it mattered to me that I got it. And I remember when they announced that they were doing that because the yearbook hadn't done that before. I remember like turning to you guys and being like, I need this. And the rest of you being like, well, it'll happen. Don't worry, but we will figure this out. Like, stop it. It's okay.
I actually do remember being like, this is really important to Aaron. And it's important, but it's very important that Aaron gets this. I do remember. It actually ties in really well with the book. I feel one of the things about The Giver that I feel like has really impressed me this time around is the way that I think it's perfectly suited to catching sixth graders' attention. And one of those things is like our love of learning things about ourselves and ceremony. And The Giver like has so much of that. And sixth graders love that stuff. Middle schoolers, like we just like all around that age are just obsessed with like, and maybe that's not awards, but like, wouldn't you have loved being assigned to a job as 12-year-old, being observed and then assigned to a job? It's part of our developmental like stage where it's like we are like learning so much about ourselves. It's delicious and so true to like my experience and I think our shared experience, like loving those kinds of like, I don't know, we had this like had these teachers who, and this came up when I was reading it, who like told us where we would die if we were a Hunger Games class, which
And that was
lives
12th
in my head.
grade.
Obviously way older than Jonas, but the idea of like being told by somebody, I see you, and this is what I think would happen. Well, kids love that stuff.
In talking about high school reunions, you mentioned community, and I think that's such an essential part of this book because we went to middle and high school where like they shipped kids into a specific area. So none of our friends like lived in our own neighborhoods. And at least for me as an only child, that made me feel really isolated and made me like really invest, I think, more in those high school relationships and those school relationships because there were people there. So I think like to have such an insular community makes a lot of sense. I think what's so weird is like that they had us do activities that existed in this community while we were becoming a community, you know, the 60 of us or whatever. And yet this is like dystopian. This is like we are euthanizing people who are too small, which would have been me. But my first thing is from the dedication, which is for all the children to whom we entrust the future. Gosh, Lois.
That's actually wild. I did not read that. I listened to an interview of hers. He really does have this sense, like this really powerful sense, like I wrote this to be powerful to kids. Like, and it is powerful to kids, and it should continue to be powerful to kids. And like a really strong message, anti-banning books, which I think we can talk about if you want
Oh,
about
yeah.
this, because it's been banned so many times. But that's so interesting that like even in the dedication, she had this like sense that it was going to be impossible, or maybe a hope.
Yeah. I think from as a writer looking at this book, I was so astonished because it is so simple. And like a very early lesson in art school was a professor. At one point, she was like, simple is not a bad thing. Like to be a simple art form and yet communicative is like a huge accomplishment. And so the language here is like very, I mean, obviously easy for sixth grade, but there is, she tells us so much, not by telling us what is present, but by telling us what is absent. So there is like, there's no set dressing, there's no talking about like, this is what the door looked like and this is what I was wearing. But it will be like 10 pages in, and they'll say, oh, he's like an animal. And then there'll be a thing of like, we don't actually know what animals are. And here we go. And that thing makes you just like stop in your tracks and be like, oh my gosh, there's like that absence of one basic thing makes us realize so much more. So later on, Jonas comes to understand what color is. And that makes you as a reader go like, oh, this whole time. They don't have any concept of that. There's so many moments where you stop and you have to like go reevaluate all of the information you've been given. A masterpiece of writing. So good.
One thing that she said in this interview that I listened to was that part of her job was to seduce the reader into the world. And I think that's exactly what happens, right? Like I can imagine myself as a 12-year-old or my students as 12-year-olds being like, this sounds like kind of a great world. Like really buying in
Yes.
because you don't realize for so long what's not there. Because it's just like you're filling it in with your experience, which is something that I think particularly this age group does so much. There's something like that happens when you're 12, which is that the hardest thing for you is like you don't know what you don't know. Like so
Yeah.
much of my job was to tell kids like, wait, there are things you don't know.
Yeah.
Wait, can you try to think of a question to ask about this? And kids struggle to like think about like what they don't know. That's like another level
Yeah.
of development. Anyway, so like I'm sure they're filling it in, and then you're coming back to it, and then by the end, you're like, I mean, by the middle, you're like shocked about how horrible this is, right?
There's all these rules. And again, it's such a good thing of like, she doesn't lay all of them out. It's just like, oh, and this was a the way. And so one thing is every night after dinner, everyone has to say like their feelings today, what happened. And I was like, great, we're like learning to name our feelings, we're sharing, we're not keeping secrets from each other. And then it is like, oh no, you like legally cannot keep secrets. There is no sense of privacy. It's such a wow, gosh, really wow.
Honestly, wow.
Well, something I want to do more on the podcast is call attention to first lines. And the first line of this is, it was almost December and Jonas was beginning to be frightened.
Mean, that doesn't give you any sense that like he's anything but a normal kid.
Yeah, I was trying to sort of, read this and say, okay, like what is the first indication that this is a world different from our own? Because it's about this first paragraph is about a plane goes overhead, and there's, he had never seen aircraft so close, for it was against one of the rules for capital P pilots. And that's the second paragraph. I think that was the thing that I was like, oh, there's something here. But then there's, I think on the next page, there's like an intercom order of immediately leave your bicycles where they are. And it's all these little tiny things that are just like, and then on the bottom of the second page, you get the first mention of being released. For a contributing citizen to be released from the community, it was a final decision, a terrible punishment, an overwhelming statement of failure.
It's so interesting that it's introduced as a bad thing, but then it's not treated like such a bad thing for so long. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting that's the first mention, and it's so early on. It's peppered throughout. I was shocked by that. I read this twice for the podcast, like once, and just was gagged at every step because I had remembered nothing. The second time was like to actually try to like internalize. And I was also shocked about how early on they started talking about that. It's like their main form of control, right?
Yeah.
Really is like their ultimate threat and their main way to control everything.
Yeah, and that it's not even that severe. The book takes place in the mind of a 12-year-old, so like you are very rooted in that perspective, but sort of Jonas sees release as like you're just leaving the community, not leaving life. So there is the sense of like, well, they'll just go somewhere else. His father works in like child rearing. And so when a child is released, they're going to a different community. And like, so then we don't need to worry and there's no concern because there is like, there's an a capital E elsewhere that they go to, which I don't no, but I think like the best books on the podcast are the ones where I run out of things to say, where it's just like, wow, gosh.
I keep chewing on that. No, absolutely. I can really chew on this book forever. Yeah, I don't, and I mean, even down to the ending. I mean, I like have been trying to think about like how I feel about the ending, which we'll talk about, I'm sure. And I'm like, I actually have no eloquent things to say. I'm left agape, and I continue to be that way, which is really like neat in a book that's like geared towards children.
Yes, in a book that's like 31 years old, to have an ending that I am like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what she's trying to tell me. I don't know what I'm supposed to feel. I don't know what I do feel.
It's interesting that it says like a terrible punishment. Like he's like, oh, that would be so embarrassing.
Yeah.
Horrible. It seems like kind of intense, but it's like more about feeling as a person and the community and less about like sad.
Yeah, it is about shame. Yeah. There's something there that comes in later about conformity and how good that feels to fit in. I have a post-it note in here that I wrote, which is, what would your assignment have been at age 12? Do you have any idea like what you wanted to do? Because obviously what you want to do and what you are assigned is radically different. Oh, similarly, this was in high school. We had to take an aptitude test of, this is the job for you. I got dictionary editor.
You did not. They did not put
I
that as an
did. I remember because I think you were near me, and I remember Jake got funeral director, and I went home that night and told my mom, and she was like, yeah, that makes sense.
I absolutely remember this moment now. Yes, I totally remember it. I have no idea what I got. I don't remember what I got, but I do remember what we got. So funny. And it does seem familiar to me that you actually got an editor. I didn't remember the dictionary part, which is absolutely. If I was 12, what would I have wanted to be assigned? The truth is that I feel like I always was. I mean, I ran for student government president. I was, doing student government. I liked a little bit of control. I think that was a big, a little bit of leadership I think I liked. So, and I have a strong sense of justice, especially as a kid. I think I had a hard time with gray. I wanted things to be right. I feel like I forced some of our friends maybe to follow rules that were maybe things I liked and wanted, not maybe what they wanted. So I think I unfortunately might have wanted, this is interesting because I've thought about what I wanted to be assigned, like what I would be assigned today. As a 12-year-old, I think it'd be like Ministry of Justice kind of vibe, which of course is like the worst possible thing in terms of like if you actually knew what was going on. I kind of feel like that's where I would have wanted something that would have like been like, yes, you are kind of smart. You know what I mean? I needed that kind of validation. I would have wanted that as a 12-year-old.
Oh, me too. One of the greatest compliments I got in sixth grade was at the end of the year, we had our like Greek unit. And so we made Greek masks for a play. And I remember our teacher, Miss Ski, going around telling, like, okay, you're gonna do this and you're gonna do that. And she was like, no one has pink lips naturally, except for Aaron. And then just kept doing her lesson. And it is stuck. I got new headshots taken yesterday, and I thought about it then. Like, he's with me. So, but I think like what you were saying is right. Like, to feel seen, to feel singled out is so huge, because like you were saying, like the world is only as wide as your experiences, and you're starting to learn that like your experiences are limited. So like any kind of little piece of I see you and you are unique, but not too unique to stand out and feel vulnerable. Absolutely wild.
100%. No, I my students craved fast with like once I told one kid or what I was comparing, like maybe a color, like, oh, you're kind of like if I could pick a color for you, it'd be orange. Like explain why the next 10 minutes we're trying not to get every kid to ask me. I was like, I never should have started this. Because kids just want, they want you to look at them and tell you something about them, which is like, it's just like a really interesting little phenomenon. I tried to pick a word for each of my students, courageous, independent, like creative for like Valentine's cards. And then one of my kids was like, I read his and you just did the same template, picked a different word. I was like, what do you want from me? That's as much as I could. But they still like didn't admit it, but they liked that kind of singling out.
I mean, you brought it up in 12th grade. We had that teacher who did like we all wanted to know what he would think of us in the Hunger Games, to the point where you had to be like, stop asking when we like get to finals as a reward. We will spend a whole day doing this. Yeah, and I still remember mine and that I was one of the last ones to survive. Yeah, of course I do.
It's so interesting. It's just like a part of who we are then. And to feel like Jonas watched, noticed, and then in that important moment singled out for then the rest of your life to be like, you can now like kind of like ride on that singling out in the community for the rest of your life. Like it's super interesting. I think going along with that, like I kind of mentioned this earlier, but like that ceremony is full of like delicious things. For 12-year-olds to be like, oh my gosh, like they love rites of passage. We kind of experience that in our own societies, right? Like, you have a graduation from middle school and like you have an elementary school graduation. But to know that certain things are happening at certain times, like most kids just like love that kind of structure too. Just to be really predictable. Something that ended up happening to me a lot as like a teacher was that kids would be like, so did kids do this last year? And the year before. Oh, kids did this project last year and the year before, and they're gonna do it next year. And like this idea that like their experience would be repeated forward and backwards forever is kind of like what they were thinking. And they love to feel like, oh, next year the kids will do this same project this year and I'll know about it, which of course is not teaching. I'm not doing the same stuff every year because I'm making it better and different and some things fail, But it's just so interesting because like kids really love, I don't know if they love it, but they expect it. And there's comfort in that kind of familiarity. And this book is like full of that. It's like, oh, you know exactly what's going to happen every year.
Yeah, that in eliminating pain and conflict is also sort of eliminating surprise. But you saying that of like what next year's gonna do and what last year's gonna do, I remember us especially going up to Miss Heaton and being like, but 2015 is the best class, right? Like the 2016 kids are not comparing, right? We just know. They have so many little fights. We're not like that.
There's like an interesting pride, and that's all right? It's interesting though that these like ceremonies didn't bond kids to each other very much, or to their teachers in this world. Like in our world, those ceremonies, like we have a camaraderie with other people in our grade, in our class, in our school, and these like connections aren't maintained in this world. It was so interesting to hear Jonas's parents tell him, like, well, soon you'll stop playing with your friends, and eventually you might forget how old you are. That was like really telling to me of like how routine their lives are. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, that was a really startling moment to me. I think because, at least in this reading, because like we have known each other for 16 years, you know? So to have them say, like, I'm probably never going to talk to this kid again was so mind blowing. But I think like that is the expectation. Like you're saying, like you turn 12, you go to your job. You stop going to school. So, like, we know that those people are just going to drop out of our lives. And then, like, those interpersonal relationships are so much less important compared to your usefulness and your productivity. And I think she doesn't lean into it a lot, but there is this attitude of like, there's no waste. There's like, everything is being used to its maximum potential, even to the point like, every little detail is so thought out. Like, there's near the end when he's like planning an escape, he's like, well, and when dinner is done, they'll put the leftovers out in the front to be recollected by the people on their bicycles. And she doesn't have to lay them all out at the beginning. There is not this big, like, 20 years ago, this happened. And so we had to restructure. Yeah, it's right in.
What like attracts me to this book is like it treats you like you're smart. And I think like I love media that doesn't have to spell everything out for me because of course I don't need the same thing repeated from three perspectives to understand what's happening. You can kind of sprinkle it in and it's more interesting and also like more exciting when you figure it out. No, absolutely. I think she does that really well here too. I think also just talking about like how they didn't maintain those interpersonal connections, I feel like it's so intentional and imperceptible as part of it. Jonas says, like, oh, we naturally are always going to be friends. But the structure of the world is so rigid, it has not allowed time for that. You cannot see your friends. There's no time. Like, you can't go to dinner at somebody else's house. You can't invite them over to your house for dinner. There's holidays, but they're random. So you can't pre-plan anything on those holidays. But it's like the structure is so rigid that it just like it phases those other relationships out without you even knowing, including parental relationships, right?
Yeah, there's to the point where like Jonas gets his job and is sort of like, oh, soon I'm not gonna have parents anymore. To the point where like they will kind of be strangers. Wild.
Crazy to think like what can be normalized,
Yes.
right? What can seem normal to him, but it's pretty believable too, because there's a lot in life that we don't peer at super super critically.
Definitely. The next note I have is at the top of chapter three, his sister is talking about this new baby they're taking care of has his eyes are pale. And the question I wrote is, I don't remember if we made fun of people's looks. Did we? I can't remember. When I talk to people about like what high school was like, I say like, no, there wasn't any bullying in our high school because we were all busy bullying ourselves.
So funny. That is hilarious. So Erin was too busy bullying herself to notice any bullying. That's clear. Me, as a
There?
member
I
of the
believe
hero
it.
club, the anti-bullying club, was firmly believed that there was bullying happening, that it was my responsibility to stop. So that's interesting in contrast.
I completely forgot that that club existed. Oops.
That's so funny. That's interesting. No, I mean, talking about differences, something that came to my mind once I realized that there was sameness, which meant sameness, and there was no color, was a remembrance of middle school using a paint color detector to see what paint color each of our skin tones would have been.
I think
And I
about this a
believe
lot.
you had a mushroom.
I was dillweed.
Oh, dillweed. I was like,
I think later I figured out you were a baby turtle, I think.
wow, posted
Oh.
something. The baby turtle is so cute. I hope it was that. I remember it was
I think
toasted or roasted something, but that's what I thought.
that sounds right. I feel like this was in high school because I remember it in the auditorium classrooms that had the folding chairs. Because my boyfriend is from Southern California. So every year that it gets cold, I'm like, one day we had to go to school when it was 1 degree outside and everyone brought blankets and we all just sat under our blankets in class, which I think happened once, but it did happen. But yeah, I think dillweed was like, actually, I was wearing a green shirt and the paint thing picked up on my shirt and not my actual skin tone, but
That makes a ton of sense. That makes more sense than me remembering green tones. And I was like, well, we're just not going to talk about that. No, it's interesting because I felt, so like based on that story, I felt that there was like we were hyper aware of differences. I don't know about it in a bullying way, but we were just hyper aware of each other's differences because you're trying to grapple with your place in the world at that age. I felt like we talked about race and ethnicity constantly, which I will tell you is something that my students do often too. But it's also tough because there are so many ways to do things wrong or cruelly without meaning to. But you're learning things so much, and I find like a big part of my job is to like let kids try to speak openly so we can have an open conversation. Because if you never say what you really believe or think, and there's no place to bounce your ideas off, and you just end up holding on to like incorrect ideas, you know? But it is kind of a tough situation. Anyway, so I remember that being a huge part of our growing up, or at least maybe just mine, because I'm white passing and grappling with like, was grappling with my own. Actually, maybe this was, am I on to you, Erin?
No. This was definitely there because I so clearly remember because it is so funny. I remember we talked about it a lot, because we were a small program. I remember once I said, "Well, you know how you're half Mormon, half Bolivian." And you said, "No, Aaron, I'm fully Mormon."
Wait, that's so cute. Gosh, that's
But yeah, no, I remember our ninth grade English class table group, because I remember being like, we have like one of every kind. We have, there was a lot of that. There was a lot of that.
yeah, there's a lot of that. It's interesting. It just really is, right? It just really it's part of that, and kids are still dealing with that in different ways. As a teacher, it's so scary and interesting. And I don't know how our teachers didn't overhear us in our very many confusing conversations, but we can't get through it. And they don't have any of that in this
They
world.
don't have that.
And they're not allowed to talk about it, even if they did notice it, right? They notice the pale eyes. There are some kids, but it would be rude to mention them. And
Yes.
they would
And that
mention
like
them.
rudeness is such a part of it.
Which is funny because rudeness for women is often like, this is like an unspoken rule, like rudeness for a lot of people, I guess. But like, I think especially for women, don't be too rude. But also, like, if you make the category of rudeness wide enough, you can no longer speak your opinions, right? And then that's what's happened in this book.
Yeah, I like how she has him kind of negotiate those ideas about how like propriety limits what you are able to talk about, and then how you see things and how you sort of make sense of the world. It is such like it is such extreme control through like things that feel very small, you know?
I mean, that is like a means of control, right? It's like these really small rules of a society.
In that, I think it's when they finally have their big ceremony. They're talking about it, and they say, "You 11s have spent all your years till now learning to fit in, to standardize your behavior, to curb any impulse that might set you apart from the group. But today, we honor your differences. They have determined your futures." Did you feel a need to homogenize? Like I feel like I did and also didn't. I don't know.
In some ways I did. I'm like I feel like probably I was my full 5'11 in sixth grade. You know what I mean? Like I stuck out in really obvious ways, so that in ways that I didn't like. So I kind of felt like I wish I could have fit in better. But I mean, I think thinness was a huge thing for me because I'm like so tall. I stick out just so much just because I'm a huge Amazon of a woman, I would say. Personally, and I think that like that was kind of a sticking point for me, but it was just never in my personality to try to be quieter than I was, and I just couldn't do that too. Like I'm a big person and I'm a big personality, and I think I just kind of gave up, and I think by doing that I also felt like I gave up other things like the real kind of popularity that makes you like beautiful and popular and desirable. I think I was just like, I'm gonna sacrifice that to be my full personality. Just not something like I recognized later, like, oh, that wasn't a sacrifice that you had to make. I think I just decided like that kind of homogeneity, I just sacrificed it. But yeah, we had a lot of characters. So I don't know if that's
Yeah, we definitely did. I mean, I think you have such an incredible luminosity and shine to you that it can't be contained. Like you're just sun, like you do radiate like more than anyone I've ever known. Like that is true. Like you can't put a shell on that. It's just gonna explode. But I think like because we were in a school that was like for the smart kids, I feel like we had been given kind of permission to be like, we know we're all freaks here. We can go a little crazy.
I think part of what maybe gave me and some people in our like similar situation permission to not homogenize as much is we fit an ideal of intelligence. Somebody told us, you are smart. And then it was like, oh, okay, I fit in this so well that I get to do because they do the other things a little bit differently. But some kids don't get that. Like they don't have that level of inner confidence in themselves in any respect. And so then they just struggle to find their place. And I see that a lot with I've seen that a lot with students, right? It's like, oh, I think it just takes like an inner something to like keep you a little bit more grounded, or else everything is telling you you're not right. And I think everybody kind of grapples with that, but maybe because we were told like this is right by authority here, I think maybe that gave us a little more permission. That's what I'm thinking a little bit.
No, I think you're 100% right.
as a, like a teacher now in a public school, I have a lot of feelings now about these kinds of programs. And part of grappling with how we single out children at a young age is why I decided to pursue education, because I felt those differences and I thought, this isn't fair. like I loved my experience. Also, how dare other kids not get this? So that's like a big pushing point actually for me in my in terms of like why I'm doing the work that I'm doing now.
Again, it is, I'm just so glad that like you exist and that everyone else gets to be so lucky to exist at the same time as you.
I am so lucky that you feel like that and you knew me the middle school. And that's something that I'm gonna hold on to forever. I'm just gonna hold on to that.
No, because I think like you just have an honesty and a kindness and a positivity that like really buoyed me through a lot of really hard times.
Well, thank you. I mean, I love you. I do feel like I've just, if we're gonna be honest back at you, I think this relationship really served us both. And then I went on to have an incredibly difficult time in my life. And the memory of your open and honest struggles got me through so much. And we weren't even in contact then.
Yeah, I
It was just
remember
a special
like
little thing we had going on.
yeah, I remember when you told me about that, 'cause it was at the creek across the street from my house, and I remember like that conversation alone really buoyed me through, because I was like, oh, this person that I have always idolized for their positivity, like saw, I think you at that point, I think you said like that took a lot of courage just to come to school every day. And I had never thought about it like that. And that really, I radically changed how I looked at myself. Yeah.
Yes.
We're just sitting here holding our faces. Yeah.
Staring at each other. Uh-oh. This is great podcast material as we look at
Yet the next thing I have flagged is Asher. Thank you for your childhood. Lois.
each other. I know she is the words that they use, I love their like star as like maybe innocuous. Dwelling into the house. Okay, that's fine. And then like the committee, and you're like, okay, I don't really understand. And then all of a sudden it feels menacing, right? In what
Yeah.
it, how you realize like it's kind of it's controlling them. Like this kind of new speak that they have, it controls them. It is cool. She paints a real picture, right? And it's so weird.
Yes. And what's so interesting is 3 years later in ninth grade, I know we read 1984, and that did not stick with me at all. I also know like our teacher was out on maternity leave. Like we were not set up for success, and that is fine. I remember like trying to get through Romeo and Juliet, and I was like, no one understands Shakespeare except for me. There was a lot of that going on.
Pushing off of our conversation about like dealing with hardships maybe as kids. If you want to start talking about The Giver, I think like I'm curious about what you think about like how much The Giver puts on Jonas at Jonas's age, how quickly he puts on him. This is something that I think is was my main takeaway from this book, is like Jonas needed to understand some hard things, but how much should we shelter kids? How much should we, especially in this society where like you had things happening to yourself, like what in your childhood. I mean, everyone kind of did that you couldn't predict. But in this society where you can predict everything that kids deal with, what do you expose a child to when you're trying to expose him to things for the first time? What a tough thing you ever had to choose to do, right?
So the giver is this person who is a receptacle for all of the memories of like the before times of when there was war, when there was poverty, when there was famine. And Jonas's job is to slowly receive those memories. And in the giver, having the memories of all of the hardship and all of the suffering and all of the pain, everyone else is spared by that. And I was thinking a lot about like the isolation of that, of the giver is separate from everyone else. He has to be. He cannot tell people about those things. And I think that like definitely resonated in terms of like, I felt like I couldn't talk about my depression. I know I had a mentality for a long time of just like, everyone is feeling this and I'm not coping well. Like everyone
Right.
else at home is having these issues and they are just like built for tough and I am not. I've been thinking a lot about like, there's this idea that like comedians come from like the darkest lives and that's why they're like able to be funnier about things. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I do think there's like, there's this I don't know. Like I had a childhood in which I needed to kind of like moderate the emotions of others and like take on responsibilities that other people don't have. And I think that made me more equipped to be an actor, to be a writer. And I think that with The Giver, there is this urgency because there had been a previous 10 years before Jonas, there was Rosemary, who failed, who, and it is revealed, was the giver's daughter, which I didn't remember. And he had to give his 12-year-old daughter, you know, all of these memories of pain and suffering. And she ends up releasing herself. It sucks so much when you're reading a book that is often banned and you're like, oh, I get it. Like, I get why people sometimes don't want their kids to see this. But I think, like, it's interesting because The Giver is like, I want to end on a high note today. I want to give you a gift of something beautiful. I know this is hard, so I want to do something else. But I think something that was so interesting to me is the idea that when a memory goes to Jonas, it leaves The Giver. So he is lightening himself. And we don't know anything about The Giver. We don't know how old he is, other than he's old, other than he is different. That was huge to me. If I could have found a way to like get rid of those bad things and put them somewhere else, I would have taken everything. In reading this, there's that moment where she says, like, thank you for your childhood. I don't know if either of us had those moments where it's like, this ends, childhood is over. And there are moments where Jonas is like, man, I wish I had it back. And like every book I've read for this podcast, surprisingly, has moments where they're like, I wish I could go back. I wish I could go back to the times when I didn't know. I think it's this thing of like, when it is just you, which so much of childhood is so isolating, it becomes unbearable. And that's sort of like the fatal flaw of this society is that like the pain cannot be shared. The pain is isolated and individualized. But it is like, I don't think we'll ever, I don't want to be a parent for a lot of reasons, but one of them is like, I don't have the answers for like when is a good time to understand death and hardship. Like, I know I was talking to my dad about this recently. In fourth grade, my great grandmother died. She was the first person I ever knew who died. I barely knew her. But the day before, I had done a genealogy project for class and like done my family tree and presented it. And then the next day she died. And I was like, oh, I did that. That was my fault, because that's just how like baby brains work. So you know what, there's, and I remember I went to so many funerals growing up, and I felt like I just like collected them, and so that felt normal, and I felt different because of that. I don't know. What do you think about that? About how the giver treats Jonas? It's such a good question.
I think my perspective as somebody who works with 12-year-olds,
Yeah.
I am a history teacher. I'm the giver now. As I was reading this, I was like, oh my gosh, why is this like relatable content for me? I mean, what do history teachers do? They give memories to kids. I was teaching kids about things they had no idea about. First person to
Yeah.
tell kids about 9/11. I taught a child about the Holocaust. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh my gosh, like. And so I feel really protective about how that is to happen. And yet I know it's important that it does happen. So it's like this really
Yeah.
tough balance because kids are sensitive and I love that sensitivity. I was extremely sensitive as a child and I want to protect that. So I don't want to give kids like so much that they like lose, they're
Yeah.
numb to issues that happen. And yet there's like so much happening in the world and like classrooms are so political now, right? Or I guess always. I'll say always. Classrooms have always been so political because like, what do you teach children about the world, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so with all of these thoughts in my head, I feel like the giver gave Jonas too much too soon. Obviously. I mean, I don't
Yeah.
know if that's obvious, but he did, right? That is like
Yeah,
very
yeah,
clear to
yeah.
me.
It is just 12 months that he is, quote, employed. Yeah.
I mean, it's way too much for a kid to deal with, especially when that kid has so few other, like, none of these things that like the giver is showing Jonas are what we call like mirrors. You know what I mean? They're not reflecting his lived experience. They're not like, they're like completely separate and like opening his mind, and he has no skills to deal with it. Of course, he has like a horribly terrible job, but like, yeah, it's like way too much too soon for a kid to have to deal with. Yeah, I just think like this idea that like, what do we choose to like show? What do we choose to teach? And everyone
Yeah.
has their own opinion of like what they wish they had been taught in middle school, what they wish they had been
Yeah.
taught in high school. And like as a teacher, I'm like, okay, I've heard it all. You know what I mean? And we're doing our best. I don't have a good answer to it, except for that, like, we're doing our best, and there's like so many outside constraints to teachers too. But books like this, I think, can be helpful for kids to like expand their minds, though, right? Like,
Absolutely.
kind of thing. But yeah. Oh, here's my question for you. Is that if you could give, I guess this is like a later on question, but just so you know, we know as the book continues, there's this idea when Rosemary releases herself, those memories somehow get released to all members of the community. And it was really difficult for all of them because, you know, we don't know exactly what kind of memories, but we know that there were memories of loneliness and a mother being taken away from her child that were really difficult for Rosemary to grapple with. The question is, if you could release one memory to the community, what memory would you release to the community?
Oh gosh. Being the giver is such a hard job, right? Because I think for me, especially when I was younger, I have like a strong mean streak in me, like a punishing streak. So I think like if I at a point in my life, if I was the giver, if I had been isolated from my family, if I had been the only person who has the concept of all of these things, I think part of me would be like the worst thing, like the worst thing that I've had to understand. All of you now have to
Oh,
understand. But
interesting.
I think it's like it's sort of like what impact do you want to have? So, it's like what can you do that I love the idea and you're absolutely right of how quickly he puts things on Jonas, like fully like puts him on a battlefield, watches a friend die, like horrific, horrific stuff. I don't know. It's like in the political world, right? I think maybe the ultra conservatives, maybe I want them to understand like what it feels like to be a trans kid, in 10th grade for 5 seconds, I think like empathy is I think a lot about being in the arts, and I think the magic of media is being able to create empathy in sharing experiences that you wouldn't have otherwise. That's like the, what do we allow kids to understand? My parents had a very strong attitude of this is a tiny adult, so we're gonna let her watch anything. And that I think maybe more sensitive, but it also made me more worldly. My memory to give would somehow put us on a more empathetic, even playing field. But what is that?
One of the powerful things about history is that it can elicit this kind of empathy, right? Like that's 100% was one of my main, there are certain standards that like kids need to learn, skills kids need to learn. And then there's like this overarching, like, how do I want like to impact these small humans and citizens of the world, right? And my head was always this idea that like history could share empathy, could build empathy with other people, people who are different, people in the world, right? I love that. I also kind of want to give space for empathy towards the giver. But I do know like there's like this idea that like he was so tired and exhausted, and Jonas is there begging to like relieve him. And the giver has all this love for Jonas, and Jonas is developing for the first time this love for the giver and wanting to take on that pain. And in your weakness, when somebody's there to relieve you, like, do we judge him based on the battle scene he gave Jonas? And that's something that like happens to parents and, you know, adult figures all the time, right? Is like, you know, you have to parent and teach through really tough things. And something I really admire about like the school that I worked in is like when elections happened, when the war in Ukraine began, there was like an email between history teachers. How are we going to approach this? Are we all good to do this? Can we tackle this? Because the kids are going to be coming with questions, and we need to be ready for the answers that aren't our own personal anger based. You know, and I had moments where like the war in Ukraine was really like shocking to me because I had lived in Ukraine as a child, and I knew that that was going to be something that the kids could not, they didn't have the capacity to feel that empathy for me. They weren't going to be able to do that for me. So how am I going to be able to like talk about it and be okay if the kids are like, who cares? Not because they're bad people, but because they don't have the capacity yet because they're still growing that. And that's something that's like so hard. And the giver had to deal with that. It's so hard, you know. So I do, while I feel like the giver gave too much to Jonas, I totally understand why.
Oh my God, I love that you're a history teacher. Oh my gosh.
I never saw it coming. I wouldn't, if you had told me, you know, looking at Mr. Ward, like, you know, like that was gonna be me, I would have been like, wait, absolutely not. But
I just have to put the shout out in, talking about media and history and empathy. I am the person I am today because of the musical 1776, which teaches us that historical figures are human, normal people who have to make really bad decisions and really bad compromises.
Brought that musical up the other day, and I like gasp squeal because for me it's like an inside joke between us. Because for me,
Yes.
that musical does not exist outside of you, and any other mention of it has to be in reference to me and you watching that at like age 14, 15, you know.
Because I took photographs of everything in high school, like I have very clear memories of some things. So I know the day that you came over to watch 1776, you were a burrito and you made a pie crust rose somehow. That was gorgeous.
I love that you have those random pictures. I do remember being wrapped up in a blanket, like, ooh. Okay, something I want to talk about is like the giver being that person to witnessing something for the first time, experiencing something for the first time. Like that kind of like special moment when the giver first gives Jonas snow and a sled. So like, that's the first memory that the giver gives Jonas, because he's trying to like use a metaphor, and Jonas has no context for anything that he's trying to say, right? Even when he's trying to like dumb it down. So he gives him snow and a sled, which I think is super interesting. And I want to know your thoughts as to why a snow and sled. But I will say that that really touched my heart because I have witnessed probably like 15 students seeing snow for the first time. In class, it happens at school because snow just starts to fall. And my students who in Boston were primarily from the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico, who hadn't been in the US long enough. And actually, just recently, I have, in preparation for the fellowship I'm about to do in Utah, I decided to start going into a bunch of Utah schools. So I have been substitute teaching in as many schools as I can here in Utah. And just randomly one day, I saw kids' first snow again, like in like November, like late October. And it's like the most precious, tender experience to like have somebody experiencing something for the first time. And the giver does that with every like huge thing that Jonas could possibly experience. And I just think like it's just so interesting. He's like a super parent, right? Like, I don't know, it's so, and with all the control in the world to like give Jonas exactly the kind of memory, I think I would freak out being the giver. Just trying to figure out what schedule I would give him things would be so exhausting. I would probably send Jonas home every day also. But it's just like so tender to think about the happy experiences, you know?
I hadn't even questioned it being snow, but I think for Lois Lowry, it is a really, really good idea because not every kid who reads this has had snow. I think that's so brilliant. It's so interesting that dynamic because it exists in a community that doesn't really have parenthood, like you said. I think it's so interesting that she picks the professions of his parents are like Minister of Justice, and like child releaser basically for there's Gabriel, who is this little baby that he brings home to take care of, and Gabriel is a twin, and you can't have twins. Do we even remember why you can't have twins? It's just special to have,
Sameness, so then they'd be
you can't have two of
different.
the same
They'd just be the
person.
same. Yeah. So Lily's like, it would be so confusing. Kind of wouldn't be, but I guess, you know.
Well,
Yeah.
and I guess because children are, you're not raised by your biological family, it makes you start to question everything of like, if there's a kid who looks exactly like me in a different family, how can that happen? And then it does answer all these questions, but Gabriel gets released because he is smaller. He just like weighs less.
Or the smaller twin gets released. Yeah, the smaller twin will get released. Yeah.
Yes, you're right. Gabriel lives. Gabriel is about to be released, and Jonas takes him and advances the plan forward because he can't let this one little kid care. And there's a moment really late on when they're talking about Jonas leaving, and they say, "When you leave, like all of your memories are going to be released into the community." And Jonas says something like, "I wish I didn't care about them." And there's a line that's something like, "But caring is the whole point."
Yes, he says to the giver, like, we don't have to care about them. Like, just come with me, right? They both know at the same time, as soon as Jonas says that, like, no, absolutely not. I think because those memories give you empathy, right? Like, because they really do care. Yeah, it's interesting because, like, Jonas has this whole turnaround on his dad. He can't even go home. He's so angry because he realizes what releasing means. His dad doesn't, and his dad's been lying about what elsewhere is to Jonas and everybody, which is not clear to me how many adults understand. Well, actually, it is clear to me. None of the adults really understand the importance of death, but it's not clear to me how many adults really know what elsewhere is. I wasn't sure about that. But yeah, it's interesting that like he hates his dad for a while, and yet at the end of the day, it's like he's looking at a bunch of children. Like, you can't hate the people who don't understand.
Yeah, it's the giver looked at him with a questioning smile. Jonas hung his head. Of course, they needed to care. It was the meaning of everything.
It is the meaning of everything.
And the caring is a choice, you know. There's the last thing that I had highlighted, other than that ending line, is that they're leaving the place, him and Gabriel. They are freezing to death. Jonas is able to transmit like memories of warmth and sunlight to Gabriel to keep him alive and keep him going. And there's a moment where Jonas he wanted to keep it, the warmth for himself, to let him bathe in sunlight, unburdened by anything or anyone else. And he makes the choice to give it to Gabriel. And that saves him. And it's just, I think the beauty of this book is it pairs these extremely complicated ideas into really simple moments of I choose to give the warmth to the other person.
Now Jonas has that knowledge, so he can make the choice. Before, in the community, he was choosing to be nice to other people. He was choosing politeness. Oh wait, he wasn't choosing anything. He was just being polite, right? He was being a good citizen. He was being like safe with other people, but it wasn't his choice to do that, to make that safe. And he can make that choice now that he knows differently, right?
There's a moment where Jonas sort of comes to understand choice, and he's like, I know it doesn't actually make a difference what color shirt I wear, but I want to choose. And that's something that comes up a lot in this podcast is like when you are a kid, there is so little that you can control that the color of your shirt really, really, really matters because it is a thing you can control and dictate.
Yeah, I love that part because it's him just like very, very recently like figuring it out. And then he like quickly comes to the idea, like the giver is like kind of like testing him. It's unclear if the giver like had these ideas beforehand. I think he kind of does already. And he's like kind of testing him, but then people could make bad choices. And he goes, oh yeah, that's true. Just kidding. You're right. Which actually comes from a good place, right? Like a place of safety, of like wanting everyone to be safe and healthy, right? Oh, okay. I'd rather have no choice than choices because of safety, right? But of course, that takes away so many other things too.
Oh, I have it right here. We relinquished color when we relinquished sunshine and did away with differences. He thought for a moment. We gained control of many things, but we had to let go of others. I want to wake up in the morning and decide things. I know it's not important, but it's the choosing that's important, isn't it? The giver said. It is incredible that like 130, 180 page book can 180 exactly. Ugh, Lois, it can like you will never run out of things to say about this book, you know? There's always going to be more to question.
What is that at the very end? You said something at the what was the end of that line from the giver? Is the choosing that's important? Is that what he says? No.
Yeah, it's the choosing that's important, isn't it?
In a weird way, the giver is like kind of respecting choice, the choice of people back and back and back and back and back, which is what they say for like a long time ago whenever this started. In a crazy way, as the giver perpetuates this cycle of like giver, receiver, as he's part of this process and he understands how important choice is. He kind of is respecting the choice that they made when they first started this community. I think it's interesting because like it's all about choice, like what's important. And I feel like because the giver was like, they decided this. This is what they decided. And it's just interesting to think about like who made that decision. And of course, they come to the conclusion it wasn't the people who are alive today, so it's not fair anymore, right? It wasn't worth it anymore. But it is interesting to say in a weird way, he does kind of respect their choice for a while.
Because he has all that empathy. Like he knows, he understands why people wanted this system because they had to experience so many bad things, and yet there is still bad within the new. He is that connective tissue between the past and the present, which is history, actually.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, they are children, and you don't want to take away that innocence.
It's just it's so painful to take it away. I do think something that's like really misunderstood, especially today about kids, is like where that exposure is coming from. And I guess it's like a good segue into like the banned books. I mean, The Giver is one of the most banned books. And it's interesting because a lot of that discussion is around keeping kids safe, right? And like what constitutes like a safe child, like what should we shield them from, which is like actually the like huge central part of the book as well.
Yes.
But kids today are being exposed to so much online that it's almost like an illusion of control when we try to like, you know, when we're so hyper fixated on books, when instead there's like so much unfiltered information coming to kids with no one to advise them and no English teacher to talk them through it, just constantly. And kids know so much more than we think. And I remember, I don't know if this is like your experience too. I remember being in middle schooler and being in middle school and thinking, I know everything. I am an adult. And some of that is kind of true. It's like I feel like I did know more than maybe people thought I knew. And then some of that's like a
Definitely.
total illusion of, you know. But you know, kids know a lot. They understand things about death. Most middle schoolers are experienced a death in the family. They understand some things about history, relationships. So do you have an
Yeah,
opinion
there's
about the banning of this book? Erin?
I think it's kind of hilarious. I think it's like banning, not having read Fahrenheit 451. It's like banning a book about banning books is kind of telling on yourself. I wonder how many people have not read the books that they're trying to ban. I think so much of life is about control and about fear, and I think it is like the TikTok and the access to information is so uncontrollable that if we can control, what they read in school, then that is some kind of salvation. I mean, I think the big bad when we were young was not really the internet, but like violent video games and like reality TV, which was so like, I mean, the things I remember about the internet in middle school was like Wikipedia cannot be trusted. And that, like, don't post pictures of yourself on Facebook doing dumb stuff because college will find out. And that was kind of it.
Interesting. Yeah. We kind of discussed this a little bit, but like in reading this book for the first time since middle school and having no memory of it, I was much more emotionally distraught than I expected. I have every empathy to people who are like, don't show my kid this thing that has infanticide. I honestly do. And I do struggle with, I'm not sure why it is, but I think just like in interacting with so many children, I just feel like there are things that you should put in school. I don't know, you know what I mean? There are things that like, right? And it's such a hard judgment call. So I have every empathy to people, but I do kind of agree with you that it's like the ultimate takeaway of this book is the sanctity of life. And if it wasn't that, then maybe it would be different, right? The ultimate takeaway from this book, an allegory about choice. And it isn't based in reality. And that helps separate it in degrees that can help kids, right? Kids understand stories versus real life. So, and that those kind of steps actually do end up helping.
Yeah, and there's such a difference of like, there's a habit, I think, in how like social media often relates to media, film and television currently, that's like if something talks about a taboo issue by including the issue, it is condoning it, which is completely false. Like, just because the book depicts infanticide does not mean it advocates for it. In fact, it very explicitly says this is the entire decision of this thing is so wrong that I have to upend everything. And yet the presentation of it is the thing that people focus on more than anything. But like you said, the point of the book is the sanctity of life, the sanctity of choice. And in banning the book, then you're violating the whole point of choice, It's the books that get banned the most are often the ones that are saying don't ban books,
I think banning books can be a little bit, it's one of those words that kind of like sparks things. It is one of those kind of incendiary terms, like book banning, right? Because it's like, okay, can we buy this book still? Yes. Is it in the public library still? Yes. So I totally understand, like, we can't fully go all the way, but there is an irony. There is such an irony in this book. Yeah. Being taken off of public school shelves, right?
Yeah. I think something so much that where we were from was fixated on, like we were talking about the differences. Like there was a headline that went around when we were in high school of like the most diverse city in America is Germantown, Maryland. And I think we took such pride in those things, such focus on the differences, but not really on how we kind of process and make sense of those differences.
There is a lot that goes into that, which is why it's so much easier to take all of them away. Yeah, it can seem so much easier. What do you make of the ending, Erin? This is the question on my lips. What do you make of this ending? I was so, okay, picture this. I am driving, my boyfriend lives in Idaho. I was driving back from Idaho to Utah, listening to this. It's dark, it's snowy. This book ends, and I am sobbing. I'm shocked. I did not expect such an ambiguous ending, such a struggle towards the end. It's not your typical, well, I guess you can tell me more about this, but it's not your typical plot that you expect from a children's book, right? It's not like the kind of ending that like wraps things together for you in a way that we expect for children. So, what do you think of this? That's a hard time.
So the Jonas flees. He's into elsewhere. He has this baby. They're dying. It's snowing. He sees a light in a distance. It's the night. It's nighttime. He sees shining lights through a window. He recognizes that they are lights that twinkled from trees and places where families created and kept memories, where they celebrated love. For the first time, he heard something that he knew to be music. He heard people singing. Behind him, across the vast distances of space and time from the place he had left, he thought he heard music too, but perhaps it was only an echo. I don't know. That's the thing. I don't know. I don't know if Jonas gets to the, because it sounds like it's Christmas. I mean, frankly, because of the tree and the lights, it sounds like it's Christmas. He hears people singing, but perhaps it was only an echo. There's a degree of like, is he hallucinating out in the woods? Is this his final?
It
Okay,
says
go for it.
earlier, like he was in and out of consciousness, and that part is like it's not damning, but it is really giving us this ambiguity, this we're not sure. And then because the memory is so similar to a memory that the giver had given him earlier, you really start to question, like, is he having the lingering of that last memory? Is it possible he actually ran into something that looks so similar?
Is it even possible that there could be a family, like in the conditions of this world, just out there, like having a normal time? It like, and I think in our conversation now, I'm realizing that perhaps this is a far more affecting book for adults than it is for kids, which is kind of beautiful. I think it's gorgeous. And I think that, like, I feel like I probably at the time was like, great, perhaps it was only an echo. Great, check that off my planner, my little Roberto Clemente middle school planner. Chuck that onto math homework, you know. And now I sit here and I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, what does it mean? Because I think maybe as kids, each of us was like, and I know exactly what the next paragraph would be, and I feel complete and comfortable in that, because I think you do make a lot of assumptions when you're younger, and I still do that. But I think like the bleak way and the realistic way is that this boy is about to die in the woods. And in talking about book banning, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. I don't want my kid who's just loved this kid and empathized with this kid for 179 pages to suddenly just die cold and alone in the woods. The other pervading thought I'm having is early sixth grade, this was the same, you know, month or two where we had outdoor ed, which was like spend a weekend in the woods. I don't know if you knew this. I got lost in the woods that when we were playing Predator Prey, I got lost for I don't know how long, like a couple hours, because I was like, this is a dumb game. I don't want to do it. And they had said, like, this pathway is the border. So I was like, I'm going to stick on the path and I'm just going to wander around and I'll give up when they say it's over and I'm not going to play. And I think I just like went into the wrong side of the pathway or something. But so I was wandering the woods. I got freaked out. I thought I was gonna die. Finally, I hear people calling my name and I come back and Miss Ski grabs me, is like taking care of me. She starts handing me candy out of her pockets. I don't know how she has all this candy out of her pockets. And that was like, that's my pervading memory of outdoor ed, which is so similar to this. But also, one last note. When I was in college, I watched Blair Witch Project for the first time, which was shot near where we grew up. So while yes, it was look it
I
up. It
know
was shot
that.
in it was shot in basically in those woods. So I was watching it and I was like, this is the forest where I got lost when I was 10. And then I did like my last assignment in all of college was I took a cinema studies class and it was like talk about how a movie that depicts your hometown does it good or bad, like effectively depicts your hometown well or not. So I was like, my professor was named Chad, and I was like, Chad, you're not gonna believe this. And I typed my little essay and then I sent it in and then I graduated. And it was
Chad made it for
so
you. He looked up everybody's hometown, saw that where yours was, and said, "I have the perfect assignment." Are you kidding me? That's crazy. That's such a good assignment for them.
So a lot of that to say, I don't know. I don't know. What do you make of the ending? Yeah.
I had a habit in middle school of making up my own endings because I suffered so much for characters. I suffered so unendingly that me and my mom would like walk through this like thought experiment of like what would we have wanted to happen? Now that's what happened. Okay, from now on, that's what happened. And to give myself that peace because I suffered. And you know what's so funny? Because we started by talking a little bit about Merlin. But me and my mom at the end of Merlin, no spoilers, sat with each other and said, "This is actually what happened." And we told a new story to each other. And that is my story for Merlin now because we hated the ending. And so for this book, unlike you, I think, Erin, I was probably sobbing at the end of this book. Or, and I did again this time. I think I would have told myself it worked. But my ultimate prevailing question is honestly, like, would this have even worked? Does this whole plan even work? We have no sense of whether or not that it really worked, but we do have a sense of if he dies, definitely would have worked. Horrific, you know? So it's like this weird, like it was a weird battle. But yeah, I want to believe that it worked. But yeah, I really suffered with this ending. I think it makes for an amazing prompt for some English teacher to say, "Now write what you think happened at the end. Write the last chapter." I mean, delicious for an English teacher. Do you think that Loris Lowry, like my thought was like maybe she wanted him to die and didn't know how to wanted to leave it so that kids didn't have that horrible. I don't know. I think he died, right? I agree. I think he died. Except for that, we know in the quartet there is like an allusion or a reference that like kind of makes you think that he probably. Oh, really tough.
I love that you brought up Merlin, because Merlin, that was the show that made me realize that people make TV. Like, that was the show that I was like, oh, I could actually do this as a career. So I never watched the last season of Merlin because I didn't want it to end. I didn't want to know. So I never saw it.
Never watch it.
I
But I
feel
sucked when you did. Absolutely. Except that you're the one who got me into Merlin, which is crazy. And I had a similar
Exactly.
just ambiguous endings for kids. Bold, brave, tough, interesting. As if Lois Lowry hadn't exposed kids to enough. She's like, and also an ambiguous.
Because I think either way, lives or dies, it is worth it. If he dies, the memories go back. You know, at least people know. If he lives, two lives are spared, you know? And isn't that like worth everything in the world to spare one life, you know?
That's so beautiful. Yeah, I actually love that. That framing is actually maybe me talking to my mom. You are really filling in for Mari Soul right now because either way, it's okay. It's gonna be okay. The good thing happened. Actually, that's healing for me a little bit. I like that. Yeah.
Beautiful. Ugh.
Delicious. Really cool, interesting book. The last thing that I also just like in terms of like the little world building we get is this idea of like going into different communities. Didn't you think that was so fascinating? Why did they do that? Like these like kids
Well,
were
I wonder.
taking trips, you know, to other
Yeah. I think maybe because we have this concept of elsewhere, right?
communities.
We have to. It's a means of answering questions because there's an insatiable curiosity in children of like, we understand there is somewhere else. So we'll go to a different community and it's slightly different. So there's novelty. But it's also that, like, if you think about running away, you're running away to a place that is almost identical, you know? So to me, it's like curbing that impulse, but also meeting that sort of like, you know, insatiable curiosity of a child is sort of what I made of it. But yeah, it is like there's a sequence where the children are like playing war games. And I'm like, how do these kids have a concept of bullets, of guns, of war? That was the one part where I was like, Lois, I don't know if that tracks as a writer, but that's me. That's me.
That also like didn't fully make a lot of sense to me. I really struggled with the idea that like, would this plan ever have worked? How do memories get? My overarching was like this thought like the giver should have, they should have just planned this out. I thought what was gonna happen was that the giver was going to release himself, pretending like he'd given away all of his memories, but actually not. Jonas would stay and help the community. I felt like, you know, Joe, like the giver's older. It just made a lot of sense to me. And then, you know, wait, Jonas was 18 and do it. But of course, that would make the most boring, longest novel in the world, right? With no time crunch pressure. So I get it. But ultimately, there's this like time crunch of Gabriel. I get it. But that I think would have been my better option, you know?
I think that like the character of the giver is so interesting, and I think reading it, you just assume a lot about this man that is like he, because he is a huge member within the system, that he has to be 100% for the system. And I think I didn't consider it until this re like this conversation about this guy is just an individual and can, you know, maybe he is making these choices and putting these things on Jonas because he is dealing with his own frustrations and emotions and is a human just like the rest of us, which I think is like growing up and getting out of grade school is like, oh, we were all going through the same stuff and just not talking about it. Like there, we were all actually having very similar experiences.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the giver, the only person grieving in the entire community, the only person grieving, no one to talk to about losing his daughter.
That scene where, because Rosemary, it's an injection, and Rosemary wants to give it to herself. Yeah, that's really powerful.
I don't understand why Rosemary did this. I can understand wanting to no longer be there. That I can understand that. I feel for her. Obviously not perfectly, but like, you know, I understand the idea of that. But wanting to give the injection to herself, not taking a lot of time, not talking to anyone about it. What do you make of?
The thing that I have to keep coming back to is that she's 12.
Ooh, fair enough.
And I think there's probably also a degree of like, I don't want to be a part of this system at all. It's like it's partly that like I don't want to have these memories, but it's like all of this is wrong. Like that's the thing that Jonas, there's a moment where he like goes back to his house and is looking through the window and it's like these children are playing and my parents are being normal and like I know the truth and I have to keep pretending. And he talks about how draining that is. And I think she understands that and is like, there's no way a human person can continue to deal with this. And I think because that relationship is so close, she sees how much it's worn on her father and is like, I can't handle that and I don't want to.
No, you've really spurred me this idea. Like it's interesting to me that the memory that he gave to Rosemary is the one that like seems like it's the tipping point, is a mother losing their child. It's not the physical pain. He dealt that with the emotional pain, and then she's the one who then dies by her own, you know, her own injection. So you're kind of spurring in me this idea that like her safe person or the person that she is closest to is her father. And then she has this idea of losing her child and realizing that's not even her father. Like they don't actually have that relationship. And anyway, that just kind of spurred me like, oh, maybe that there was like an additional, like, that's not even a safe person for me. I'm not even gonna go back to that person because the thing that's really weighing on me is mothers losing their children. And that's not a relationship I have with this man either.
Yeah, that's the thing of I didn't even occur to me that those two are not biologically related. And they're not. That's like that's the system of the whole.
Interesting. This is so
And
helpful to
there's a
me. We
movie.
should do this for every book. I want this for every book. And this is why I listen to
Yes.
your podcast all the time.
I'm also thinking of doing a series on this podcast or just separately in my life of every Newbery Award winner, you know, the best children's book. Also, just for farts and giggles, every Pulitzer Prize winner. Because I want to have a shelf where it's all of them. It's very much like a completist thing. I just want to have it.
It's so funny because I think the reason that I am attracted to your podcast is the same reason I think you feel like you're making it, right? Which is like gaps. I want to catch everything that made people who they all are about them and like major ones, right? That I wasn't missing my childhood, which nobody gets everything, but yeah. Love it. I feel just so honored to have been here. I'm so excited. I'm so sorry that you have to edit like 4 hours of content now.
No, it's so exciting. And we haven't even said the final question. Would you consider it required reading?
I, have a hard time requiring teachers to do anything. But I know it's not really your
With
question.
that said,
Never force a teacher to do anything. No, I feel like this is super powerful. I mean, as one of the first dystopias, like that is focused for young adults, I feel like it can be so helpful. Dystopias are a way that we can view our world in the extremes. You take one lever and you push it all the way up and you see what happens. And I think that that can be really helpful in like trying to sort out our values in a community, in a society. And so I love that this one's geared towards kids. It's powerful, it's painful, but I love it. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. It's like, oh my God, yeah. And it's so crazy to me that this is just some guy. I really thought this was an old Hollywood actor. I was like, if I just go through all of like the 1960s epics of like a Ben-Hur, like I'll find this guy. No, this is a painter named
That's
Carl.
hilarious because I've always been like, that's some dude. I'm like, that's clearly some random guy. He really is the face of The Giver until the movie, which I watched in preparation for this podcast, but honestly got as much playtime as it deserved in this podcast, which is nothing.
Good, because that's a, like I've always been ever since I was very young, I have always imagined books as movies in my mind. That's just how I work. And like this, because of how absence works in this, like you can't turn it into a movie. Like, because if the movie is in black and white, then you're telling us this is a world without color. Like, it just doesn't work. It must be a book, and it is beautiful in that.
100% agree. And that's what I felt when I watched the
Well, is there anything you'd like to plug where people can find you? Anything you want to tell people to do?
movie. I mean, I'm an educator and I actually do love to collaborate with other educators. I just recently finished a fellowship in Massachusetts where it was like kind of empowering educators to like use their stories to advocate in policy. So feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. Is that so cheesy? But you can and message me, and I would love to collaborate with you if you're a passionate educator about something. And I'd like to plug required reading because I'm obsessed. And thank you so much, Erin Bowles. I've been a fan for 15 years, and I will continue to be a fan. So thank you so much.
Oh my gosh. Oops, I know that cuts off a little abruptly because I realized that Trish and I were gonna talk for like 45 more minutes about stuff we should do, including, we're gonna start a little Pulitzer book club. I don't know if anyone else is interested in that. I made a whole spreadsheet. It's adorable. But now it's not showing up on my Google. Whatever. If you'd like to support the podcast, please go to buymeacoffee.com/required reading because I will not have health insurance next year unless something changes. I don't know. Cross your fingers. Cross your fingers. When this comes out tomorrow, I will be on the phone with Medi-Cal. What else? Next week, we are going to be reading A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens with return guest Professor Carly O'Brien. This episode is going to drop on Christmas Day. If you would like to be in a little Instagram group chat book club for required reading, just let me know. We also have coming up on the podcast Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier and then Redwall by Brian Jakes. It is pronounced Jakes. I know. So disappointing. I am also launching on Depop a corduroy store. It's called Corduroy Junction. If you like thrifted corduroy, that's where I'm at. All right, you can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. I love ya. I love you. Thank you. This was a long one, and it deserved to be. Next week, Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.